Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Hope May, and I'm joined with philosophy student and newly minted graduate, Miranda Dover.
Hi.
So, if you are new to Ethics Talk, let me just say a couple of things about the show in general, and then I'll start talking about this show in particular. Ethics Talk was something that we did at Central Michigan University in the Department of Philosophy and Religion. I think we began Ethics Talk maybe 12 years ago-ish. We have done over 100 episodes with over 422,000 downloads. The show has been in hiatus for a number of years, for 8 years, I believe. And because of the COVID-19 pandemic, we have been in the process of reviving the show, and so this is part of that effort, and we do hope to be regular as we were at one time. So if you're interested in other shows, you can access at least some of the archives at Blog Talk Radio, and you can scroll through the various topics that we have discussed. Today's topic is the title of the show, as you can see maybe, is What We Owe to Ourselves, Duties to Ourselves, and What It Means to Violate Them. And really, this topic arose out of an independent study that I have been doing with Miranda on the topic of humiliation. And in the last few years, humiliation as a psychological factor has been recognized as playing a role in international conflict. And this interdisciplinary scholar named Dr. Evelyn Lindner is really the pioneer of this work, of recognizing and pointing out humiliation as a factor in international conflict. There has been another book of late on humiliation and international conflict by political scientist Bernard Beydi, but really Evelyn Lindner is the pioneer of this work. And when we talk about humiliation and international conflict, of course, we're talking about at least two different groups, one would think. But this show, hopefully, if we get to it, is using this framework that we will set out in a moment of international humiliation or humiliation between one person and another and applying that framework to oneself and to talk about this topic of self-humiliation or violating duties that one has to oneself. I'll probably end with this quote, but I want to begin with this quote to just anchor the conversation and to have you, the listener, be mindful of this quote so that you're perhaps more appreciative of what we're trying to do in this show. And this quote is from Hamsok Han, who was a Korean philosopher, and he says this: belittling others is criminal. Belittling oneself is even more criminal, for all crimes flow from this. So belittling oneself is the most criminal act because all other crimes flow from that violation of at least a duty to oneself. So that's where we hope to go. But to begin, we're going to start talking about this, what we, Miranda and I, have been calling A to B humiliation, that is, one person to another, or one group to another. And so before getting into that definition, I'll say first, humiliation is also seen to be very connected to another concept, and extremely important, of human dignity. And to begin this conversation about humiliation and its connection to dignity, I am going to play a short clip of Evelyn Lindner's. You can access the entire speech from which this clip comes on the show page. There's a link to a video, and this clip is coming from that. So this clip is a little bit over a minute long, and again, it links humiliation and dignity.
If we look at it, then there is one very interesting turning point in 1757 that has to do with humiliation, how humiliation is defined, and dignity. In 1757, in the English language, in the encyclopedia, for the first time, to humiliate is defined as to violate the dignity of an individual. It is antisocial. For the first time before, it was pro-social. It was pro-social to humiliate a person into humility. Like the man of the house had the duty to beat his disobedient wife, to teach her respect and humility, respect for the hierarchy. So it was his duty to humiliate. It was pro-social. She should learn humility and respect. And we still have that around the world, the Taliban. We have many societies where it's like that. So in 1757, in the English language, we have this shift from pro-social to antisocial, and basically it is the forerunner of 1948, when we declared as humanity, we declared that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. So 1757 is kind of the first step toward that.
Right, so that was Dr. Evelyn Lindner, and I don't know if you caught the whole clip, but humiliation at the very least is a violation of one's dignity. That begins our deep dive, at least into the definition of humiliation. And so, Miranda, could you read this other definition of humiliation that Lindner gives?
Yes, and this comes from her book, Making Enemies, that was referenced earlier. And it says, I define humiliation as enforced lowering of a person or group, a process of subjugation that damages or strips away honor or dignity. To be humiliated is to be placed mostly against one's will, and often in a deeply hurtful way, in a situation that is greatly inferior to what one feels one should expect. Humiliation entails demeaning treatment that transgresses established expectations. The victim is forced into passivity, acted upon, and made helpless.
Mm. And do you want to say a little bit about that definition?
Yeah. So my two biggest takeaways from that definition is that there's these two key parts. There's the spatial symbolism of being lowered and treated below one's status or below one's worth. And there's also this key piece of expectations. Now, whether that be your personal expectations or societal expectations, there's this standard or this bar that we feel others should meet when it comes to the treatment of us. And so perception also plays a key role in this whole process.
Mm. Okay, so what we have on the table so far is that it's a violation of dignity. There's this spatial idea of being lowered, and there's also this component of violating or transgressing one's expectations. And you said that so this perceptual component, this perception is involved in humiliation. Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so a lot of it for me, I think, is knowing where your worth comes from. And if you, we've discussed it a lot during our meetings, like if you know your worth, it would be harder, if not impossible, to humiliate you, because your worth is not a moving target. that you're trying to like secure or to find, and others' actions or thoughts about you don't define who you are or your worth because it's grounded already, and so they can't really affect it as much.
Mm. Cool. I want to say also that if you're listening and you want to call in with a question or a comment, you are free to call in. The number maybe is on your screen, but if not, it's 516-387-1449. That's 516-387-1449. So this perception of being humiliated is connected with the understanding of your value. And so I think what you said is you could not really be humiliated if you know your value. Is that, am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow. Okay. So in that sense, if A is humiliating B, if one person is humiliating another, then the person who feels humiliated maybe is making a mistake. I don't know, but I want you all to think about that. And as you think about that, I'm going to play another clip from Dr. Lindner where she is discussing this act of one group humiliating another, and she does focus on the example of Rwanda, which was the subject of her doctoral research. This clip is about 2 minutes, and here it comes.
Then we look, for example, at Mandela. He was born down. Then he went up to the, you are from South Africa, he went up to de Klerk, to the white leader, and he said, look, times have changed. No longer is it legitimate for you to arrogate superiority. No longer. Please, I invite you to step down and to join us all, the rest of us, in equality and dignity, in a new world where everybody is equal. Please don't cry, oh, humiliation, my privileges, I'm entitled to my privileges. Don't. Come down quietly. And then Mandela went to his black brothers and sisters and said, it's not nature's order or God's will that you are down. No, it's a violation of your human rights and your dignity. You have a right to get angry. You have a right to rise up. And here is the big, big, big danger. In Rwanda, something similar happened. In 1959, there was a Hutu revolution, and the underlings rose up. Hutu is servants. They rose up. But what did they do? They didn't stop in the middle. They rose up. They wanted to become the new masters and exterminate the old masters. So there was a genocide. So they were encouraged in 1959, and the result was a genocide. So what Mandela did, he stopped in the middle. He did not say, and if he had said to his black brothers and sisters, take your hammers, take your machetes, take everything you have, go to your white neighbors and kill them. Perhaps they would have done that. Could have been. You know, my third book on gender and love, Desmond Tutu wrote the foreword, and he said the white people in South Africa don't know how lucky they are. So it could have easily become like Rwanda. Okay, it didn't. And so this is what all human rights defenders need to know. If you empower people and say, so-called empower, and say, please get angry, you can go very, very wrong. So therefore, I don't use the word empowerment anymore, because it doesn't have this stop in the middle. I use entrustment instead.
Hmm. So again, it's Dr. Evelyn Lindner juxtaposing the these different cases of humiliation, what we're calling A to B humiliation, one in the case of South Africa and the other in the case of Rwanda. And Miranda, do you want to say anything about this clip?
Yeah, so I really like this juxtaposition. I think it's a really great way to sort of get this concept. The situations were so different and had such different outcomes. But I sort of, this might be a silly example, but the way I see the difference between them is the Hutus and the Tutsis were competing for, call it a spotlight. It's like one position that is fundamentally above all of the others. Mm-hmm. And so the lower class wanted to remove the current spotlight holder, if you want to call it that, and take the spotlight for themselves. In South Africa, what Mandela suggested was instead of seeing it as this spotlight or this one position, only one can be above the other and there's this inherent inequality, but rather he suggested that everybody meet in the middle. Let the higher class step down and let the lower class step up so that everybody is on the same playing field. It's like, again, might be a silly example, but Goldilocks and the Three Bears. There's the best one is in the middle where it's not too hot and not too cold. It's not this extreme, I have to be above you, you have to be below me. It's, we can all just coexist and respect each other's human dignity that we all equally share.
So, cool. And what I hear you saying is that there can be this fundamental mistake of wanting to be, as you say, in the spotlight and on the top of all people. Instead, what is needed is for people to come down and meet in the middle. But I mean, and you and I have talked about this, like the difficulty, like what's the incentive for people to, for like a so-called, you know, master or someone on top to lower themselves, as we're saying.
And that is so the issue, is because the people who have, they're on top, they have it. They don't have any incentive. In fact, they have a pretty high incentive for keeping things very much how they are, because in either scenario, whether they step down to equality or are lowered and humiliated by those who they used to oppress, they're losing something. There are privileges to being on top that don't come with equality. And so the incentive is not there. And honestly, the incentive isn't there for the lower class to stop at equality either, because they're still taking less than what they see their oppressors having. They aren't going to get all the way to this master class status because that inherently requires a lower class. You can't have an upper class if there is no lower class. But the incentive, if we could get it, people to understand this, would be peace in our time. This, Lindner talks about this, this is the only way to actually establish human rights, is to see everybody as part of the human race first.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And so, yeah, this is the profound connection to dignity, which with which we began, which is really this has become a foundational concept, as Lindner says in the clip, the first clip that we played, that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, sort of recognizes this concept as being absolutely fundamental to peace in our time, as you put it. And indeed, like getting clear on what this means is another task. And so we, like, again, like we've been talking about, okay, there can be this power dynamic between two different groups of people, and the incentive to change that is peace in our time. And of course that word peace can also be parsed. And I think we're like sort of zooming in on the next portion of this talk, which again is about the humiliation of oneself. We've been talking about again, A to B humiliation. And Immanuel Kant is the philosopher to really flesh out the concept of human dignity. And he also says, in connection, like with this question of what is the incentive for one person to walk towards the middle, or for both people to walk towards the middle. And I think he's going to say something like autonomy or individual peace or individual tranquility. We can't spend a whole lot of time talking about Kant. We merely flag him, but we're going to begin the transition to this other main question, which is about humiliation of oneself. So if you think about this question that we're asking, which is, okay, you have, you know, this dynamic between people of where someone is on top and another person is on the bottom, and humiliation occurs when someone who is expected to be valued in such a way is not and lowered. So can we apply that to oneself, right? Can we also talk about within ourselves something being on top and something being on the bottom and something expecting to be treated a certain way and not being treated that way? This is the real purpose of this dialogue. But I want to begin by just saying, like, at least in Kant, okay, we've been talking about you have this humiliation from one group to another. So Hutu, Tutsi. There's two different groups. But in Kant, you have, as Kant says, two different beings in your body, what he calls the homo phenomenon, which is like yourself as an animal being in space and time and so forth. So that's one being inside of your one body. And the other being is this, what he calls homo noumenon, which is a moral being connected to something he calls the moral law. The details of that are beyond the scope of this talk, but I just want to flag that, okay, so in Kant's theory, you do have like these two human beings in one body. And once we have that kind of framework, we can perhaps start to also talk about a cycle of conflict or a cycle of humiliation and so forth. Do you want to say anything about that, Miranda?
Yeah, so I totally get that because I didn't necessarily know what to call them before reading Kant. But there is this, like, very driven, very intellectual, very perfectionistic part of me that is always seeking, is always trying to improve or think on things or do my best, and it's very in my head and moral. And then there's also the part of me that would rather just honestly eat Cheetos on the couch and watch TV all day. And it's like very animalistic, very impulse-driven, very, well, not very driven at all, but yeah, impulse-driven. And yeah, so I definitely can see that within myself.
And I just want to point out that Kant is not the first philosopher to talk about this dissonant psyche, if you will. This, like, there's like two forces or two energetic tendencies in a single human being. If you go back to Plato, which is some 2,500 years ago, you have Plato talking about three different parts of the soul. But he does say that there's like this rational part and there's this appetitive part, a sort of desiring food and drink, like desires of the body. And then there's this rational part that desires learning and order and ordering one's life and so forth. So there's a long tradition of identifying these different tendencies within a human being. So there is a philosophical pedigree there. And I too also experience that inner division. And I've been trying to harmonize the two for much of my life. And again, if you're listening and you want to contribute, have you experienced this inner division, this dissonance within yourself, you can either Skype in or call in 516-387-1449. So, okay, at the very least, both of us, Miranda and I, have experienced this, like there's two different things inside of us, what we can call it what we want. And anything else you want to say before I move on about this bit?
No, I think we covered it. I just completely relate to it.
Yeah, it definitely helps to call it out, to name it, and to have a name for it and a name for the phenomenon of what's happening when one side conquers another or overpowers another. It definitely helps to have a framework for talking about that. And Kant gives it to us, and also Plato and Aristotle. Many philosophers give it to us. So number one, point one with Kant, one thing to keep in mind to help us go forward into this question of self-humiliation is that there's at least two different tendencies or forces within a person, at least according to Miranda and myself. and number two, I want to refer to just a passage that we do find in Kant. And we're getting a little bit of ahead of ourselves, but we're going to come back to this point about self-knowledge. But on the show resources page, there's a link that says download the show resources here, and that will take you to two pages in Kant's Metaphysics of Morals, sections 440 and 441. And those sections have further subsections, and this is section 15 if you want to find it. But in that section, he says that when you develop self-knowledge, you're going to also develop impartiality in judging oneself in comparison with the law, and sincerity in avowing to oneself one's inner moral worth or unworth. And it's really that last phrase that relates to this conversation about humiliation, A to B humiliation between groups. Because Miranda, what you were saying before is that peace in our time requires these parties to meet in the middle and for all people to recognize that everybody has inherent dignity. And so when Kant says, okay, I am going to have the insight that I have inner worth or unworth, and that may be like I'm recognizing that I'm not more worthy. No one is more worthy. And so this like position of superiority is not valid. And I just wanted to flag that sentence and connect it to what you were saying before. So I'm flagging two different portions of Kant's framework and relating them to this conversation. Do you want to say anything about that little bit?
Yeah, so it's so powerful, and self-knowledge is so underrated and unpromoted in society. And maybe for good reason, because there's definitely a lot of power behind it. And if you can tackle the obstacle, it will open so many doors. Some you may have tried really hard to keep closed, and others that you couldn't imagine how great they were to open. And so it's this judging yourself honestly against the law and really acknowledging your moral worth and unworth, and when you are worthy, and the good things that you do, and giving yourself credit for that, but also taking the time to reflect on maybe your more unworthy moments and say, take ownership of that and say, you know, that was me too. And until you can admit to that, you kind of are impeding your self-growth.
Cool. So, belittling others is criminal. Belittling oneself is even more criminal. So you're not saying that if I'm like owning up to my unworth, I'm belittling myself, right?
No, I think it's more belittling to think that you are so unaware that you could honestly think that you haven't had all these unworthy moments. I think taking true ownership of the facts is, I don't want to say empowering because Linda doesn't like that word, but it is a little bit, because if you can be honest with yourself and stop trying to protect yourself, you're belittling yourself by thinking you can't handle the truth or that you don't really know the truth, because anybody who says they're perfect has some things to face up to. That's just part of what makes us human, is our imperfect moments. But if you don't recognize your flaws and you can't name them, how can you ever change them?
And we do have a caller on the line, and caller, I'll get you in just a second. But I just want to say, like, you, like, talking about truth, again, like, this is of the utmost importance to Kant. Like, we don't have time to talk about it. But I just like, flag it perhaps for another conversation. We're going to take this call, and then we're going to go more deeply into the topic of self-humiliation. So let me get the caller on the line. Caller, are you there?
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can. Where are you calling from?
Excellent. My name is Randy. I'm calling from Waterford, Michigan.
Okay. Hi, Randy. Welcome to Ethics Talk.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm very interested in this. In this conversation and this subject matter, it happens to be something that's directly relevant to almost every moment of my life, actually, because this idea that you can get split internally between different parts of yourself has been this ongoing, interesting part of, you know, my introspection. And the idea of humiliation comes in so clearly when, you know, the part of us that does this act of will, this part of us that wants to put activity into motion, has to command another part of us to essentially, like, obey. And built into that framework that is, like, how we make choices and how we do things, like, inherently has the possibility for humiliation in either direction, right? So if the part of us that does the willing says, we need to do this, but the lower part of us, whatever that is, I don't even know if lower makes sense. It's like that part of us has this ability to say, I don't know about this, I don't know. And we refer to that as our conscience. I think we do. And so there's this immediate tension with every choice that I find so amazing, and I'd be interested to hear if there's resources to look into on the subject, but it's something about the internal need to be the director of our own lives that starts to contradict the world around us. And somewhere within that mess, we start to get really unclear about what it is that we want, what it is that we want from others, what it is that we want from ourselves, and we start to sort of unravel.
Yeah, Miranda, do you want to respond to that? And we have another caller on the line, so caller, we'll get to you in just a second, so I see you. But Miranda, do you want to respond to Randy's comment?
Yeah, so it is that mess, and it's trying to figure that mess out that is so powerful. And it is, like, every choice we make, we have to have this whole internal debate. And it's like, even choices that you think would be easy, like, what do you want to have for dinner? But then there's more. Like, do you want to make something healthy at home, or do you just want to go get drive-thru? And, yeah, it's constantly trying to keep everybody in your head happy when they are so often at odds. And, yeah.
So Randy, for the record, you too have this experience of, like, different forces in yourself competing with each other, just for the record.
Most certainly. and
okay.
It most profoundly shows itself through addiction and various kinds of attachment, right?
Yeah,
so,
cool.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, we're going to hopefully get to that, but let me just get this caller on the line because maybe they have a response to you as well. Okay, caller, are you there?
Hi. Riley.
Hi, Riley. Are you calling from Mount Pleasant?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Unfortunately, Randy has dropped, but hopefully he'll call back in. But did you want to respond to Randy or a specific comment? Or?
When I called, I realized that what I was listening to on the internet was a bit behind where you were, so I'm not quite sure what you're talking about right now. But
okay,
I called to talk about the like self knowledge and of self worth.
Okay,
as far as it goes, like person A to B.
Okay, go ahead.
So, it reminded me of the teachings of Dogen Zenji, who is like 13th century Japanese Zen monk for Buddhism, and his like idea of Buddha nature is that like all sentient beings, so all humans, have this Buddha like this internal Buddha nature, and like what that means is interpreted differently, but kind of the main thing about it is that like you're like the teaching is like your fundamental Buddha nature cannot be like damaged or tarnished at all, and like the study and practice of Zazen is kind of a meditation, and he says to study the way is to study the self. So I feel this like connection here, and I just wondered if that might help.
Yeah, totally.
This.
Awesome. We're going to talk about self-knowledge more in just a minute, so we're going to come back to that point. There's someone else calling, and it may be Randy. Let me see. Caller, are you there? Calling from 248. Anybody home? Okay, then. Well, if you're there, caller, calling from area code 248. You are online. Okay, well, anyway, going back to this self-knowledge, this intrinsic value, so you're saying in Buddha nature, okay? Riley, in this teaching of Buddhism, do the Buddhists talk about this inner conflict that we have been talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
I had been kind of thinking of it as from the point of view of like not allowing yourself to be humiliated.
Okay. Say that again. You heard
like,
it as
like the teaching of Buddha nature where I was a thinking about it from was relating back to what Miranda said earlier about like knowing your self-worth could make you like not be humiliated in a situation where like you might if you don't.
Right. Cool. All right, so going, like, doing a, like another pass at this inner conflict that we've been talking about, as I've said, the Greeks recognize this, and they name it, and they call it akrasia. They call this weakness of will. And this is actually not just a conflict, but a failure. And they do, as I said before, make a distinction between this rational part or this part that can advance or promulgate principles, and then this appetitive or desiderative part, this faculty of desire, and that these will come into conflict and desire will win. The word akrasia itself literally means from the Greek loss of power or weakness of will. And so we go back to the question of whether this is in fact humiliation when desire conquers reason. And I'm going to turn it back to Miranda for this question. Do you have something to say about this one?
Yeah, so we have discussed it as sort of when you set a rule for yourself or self-legislation, like we say, and you're not able to follow through or you don't follow through. And is that humiliating to yourself? And so I would argue yes, at least in some cases, absolutely, because it's this animal impulse sort of making your moral self a slave. You are, as the definition above said, or earlier says, you are forced into passivity, acted upon, and made helpless. And so I think we've all at least felt some time in our life where we wanted so bad to do something. We wanted to make this change or to set this rule or whatever. And it's like, despite our best intentions and our best efforts, that impulse won out. And I think that is self-humiliating to be lower than what you actually are, because humans are self-legislating beings and we are less of that ability. And to fail or falter in that can be humiliating.
Raleigh, do you want to comment on that one?
Yeah. So I was thinking that, like, it almost seems like there's kind of two types or different degrees of humiliation that could happen here.
Mm-hmm.
So there's obviously the first of, like, going against the law you've legislated for yourself, and you're degrading yourself by doing that, which is humiliating. But then I think there's also another part to it where if you do find yourself in a situation of weakness of will and you don't, like, if you, like, really blame yourself for it, a lot of times, depending on the person, that could make you feel like you are actually less worthy and cannot get better in some sort of way. It's like a proof to yourself. And I think that, like, that's where the real humiliation is like, if you're not balanced. So, like, this, like, law you've set for yourself is, like, too great, whatever. You were in a situation that, like, you weren't strong enough for, but you can move away from the humiliation if you recognize that, like, you can put in the effort and, like, still come back from this right now. And without that idea that you can get better and you can change and you can come back from it, I think that might be part of where some of the humiliation comes from.
Yeah, and I would say, given what you said before about everyone has this essential Buddha nature and it can't be tarnished and so forth, that the judgment that I'm not worthy is a mistake, because if we all, you know, everybody has this inherent Buddha nature, and Kant calls it, you know, inherent in inherent and inalienable moral worth. It's a mistake to think that, to stay in that feeling of inferiority, I would say.
Yeah. And there's, like, the idea that every single moment, and there's 65 moments in one snap, which is, an arbitrary number, but every single moment is a moment to reset your intention. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the idea of, like, if your attention goes away, some teachings are, like, don't think of it as a mistake even. Just, like, drop it and, like, say whatever and then be like, yeah, I fucked up. Yeah, I messed up. And then, just bring it back and bring yourself back to the moral law or bring yourself back to who you think you are, what you should be.
Mm-hmm. Miranda, any comments?
I completely, completely agree. Yeah, and I think it goes back to this quote that you keep mentioning about belittling others being criminal, but belittling yourself is just so much worse. And to take ownership of an action and to admit that there was a mistake or a failure, that's one thing, and that is self-knowledge and important. But to then internalize that and say, if that one action that I did, and like you said, there's 65 moments and you're doing a million things at once, and if one of them is unworthy, that doesn't inherently make you unworthy. It just means something you did wasn't great. And so it's, I think, important to both acknowledge the reality of a situation without internalizing that as a failure in your character. And I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely
cool.
agree with that.
Anything else?
No.
I can...
No?
Yeah,
so we've been talking about if I can retrace where we just were. We talked about akrasia, and we talked about this weakness of will and being overpowered. And Riley, you said there's like two different ways you can understand that. You can interpret that as being overpowered, but when that happens, someone can like use that as evidence for their lack of worth. Is that a correct interpretation?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what we're saying is, well, that even if someone may think that that's a mistake, and that is to really belittle oneself in the worst way. So we had some other we have this very general example that we get from the Greeks of akrasia or weakness of will, but I also wanted to look at some other examples, maybe just one other example, and let's look at the example of an abusive relationship and whether or not this is an act of some kind of weakness of will or what else is going on here. Is this an act of humiliation? And so the example that I always come back to that I've talked about in some of my classes is this case that just happened recently where a young man received like 50,000 texts from his girlfriend. And the girlfriend basically said in 50,000 texts, "You're worthless and you need to kill yourself," like 50,000 times. And sadly, the young man did kill himself. And it's always struck me that, 50,000 texts were sent. And my question is, like, after how many texts do you just realize this is an abusive relationship and I need to walk away? But the sad thing is that many people stay in these abusive relationships where they're very much devalued. And so my question, and I'll start with Miranda, does it make sense to say that there are duties to oneself that are being violated in an abusive relationship like that? Let's assume that you are the one, being abused. Is that a violation of a self-duty?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One, if not more. But just for the record, it might be clear previously, but that 50,000 number, that's not like you exaggerating. That was a factual number, 50,000 text messages, correct?
Mm-hmm. Something like that. It's like in the tens of thousands. Maybe I'll post the article to the show resources page.
Right. I wanted the viewers to understand.
Yeah, it was some ridiculous amount. It wasn't like 10, definitely not. But even that's
right.
Too many.
It wasn't an exaggeration. It was really just that ridiculous. But
mm-hmm.
I think absolutely there is violations of duties to oneself in an abusive relationship. I think the most obvious one goes back again to this self-knowledge and knowing where your worth comes from and knowing what your worth is. Because if you don't know where it's coming from and you're not sure about what it is, it can be very easy for someone to convince you exactly where it's coming from and exactly what it is, whether that be true or false. And in an abusive relationship, it is often the time that the abuser is treating them horribly and not doing really anything good for the relationship, and then convince the person that they're actually doing more than the person deserves. You don't even deserve this. You deserve worse. You're lucky to have me. And so then whether they already sort of have this mentality or whether this mentality came from their abusive partner, they now think, well, I deserve less than this. I'm lucky to be in this relationship. I'm just glad to have a partner. He's better than I deserve. And you're just happy to fill that box. Mm-hmm. But if you know what your worth is, then no one can convince you of less. You can say clearly, no, you're not treating me with what a person who has human dignity is worth. You are treating me less than that. And unless you are really clear on what that is, it can be very easy for someone to take advantage of that.
And I would add on to that, unless you're really clear about where your value comes from, you can also fall into this mistake of believing in your own, like your self-humiliation. Right?
Right.
So it goes both ways. And so this is why, and so finally we're here. The self-knowledge, like the self-knowledge thing is the remedy to humiliation, both of the other and of the self, which is the primary disease, if you will. And this involves, knowing your value and on that, Riley, did you want to say anything about this? We have like about 5 minutes left, so we're going to have to go quickly. But if you have a quick comment on self-knowledge or abusive relationships, now's the time.
I don't have one that's quick enough, so I'll.
Alrighty. So with the self-knowledge as a remedy, this is not only a remedy, so the title of this show is What We Owe to Ourselves, the Duties to Ourselves, and What It Means to Violate Them. And the primary duty that Kant says that we have to ourselves is the duty of self-knowledge. this is the primary duty, and he says that there are two steps. I call it the self-knowledge two-step. And it's easy for me to remember. But he says this in this short passage that we've posted to the show resources page. The first step is to remove your evil will. Now, this is in everybody. This is the first step. And so, Miranda, did you want to, like, expand on what you think he means by evil will?
Yeah, so for me, I sort of see it as like a mask or like a blindfold that is very hard to not very hard to remove because you just, well, yeah, but it's very hard to want to because we have this vested interest in protecting ourselves from self-knowledge because we think, and it is, it's scary, and you have to own up to a lot. There's a lot of messy stuff involved in that, removing the evil will. And so it's being willing to take the mask off and to look at yourself in the mirror without all the candy-coated coverings and masks and makeup and just looking at you as you truly are in that moment and being aware of it and okay with it and just really truly getting to know yourself as you are.
And again, this emphasis on truth as the sort of medicine, and like being truthful with yourself, being honest with yourself, and as we know, truth hurts. And facing this thing, and Kant himself says the journey into self-knowledge is hellish. So it's not a cakewalk. And the removing of the evil will first involves owning up to, your faults. And one, it's almost like going back to Riley's point, like if you don't have an anchored sense of value and you're just like looking at your faults, you could just, use this as proof of your lack of worth. So it's very, very tricky. But, take heart, because in the same passage, Kant says you have this, like, inherent and inalienable moral worth. Like, it is there. And going back to the Lindner clip, I think when she was talking about Nelson Mandela, he said to, his fellow South Africans, you're pushed down, but this is not God's place for you. Like, you all have inherent rights and dignity. And so, like, that idea that, I have value, where does that come from? And it comes from, in that case, Mandela saying it to them. And if you read Kant, it's coming from Kant saying, like, you have this thing in you. But if you don't have that, if you don't have this idea, or like, everybody has an inner Buddha nature, or another way to put it, it's just very, very difficult. Riley, do you want to get a last word in? Because we've got about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I think it just gets kind of sticky because you have to be careful with how you take it. Because I think saying that you have this inner worth that's like can't go away, it's there. Some people have an inflated sense of ego, so that could make them like go a bit too far. So it's like, I don't know, I think it's all about paying attention to yourself, like Miranda was saying too. And that's kind of the idea between, or with Zen meditation and like finding out what this inner Buddha nature is. Like you find it through sitting with yourself and just like listening and paying attention. And it can be really painful. And it's kind of this, I think it's kind of the same thing Kant was saying of like going to like the hellish fires or something of self-knowledge.
Yeah. Right. All right, well, we have about 50 seconds left. So we're going to end it there and perhaps come back next week. But I just want to say to respond to Riley's comment that you may have like this inflated sense of worth. Kant does say that like when you really do examine yourself, that will be kept in check. That's what he says. Your self-esteem is kept in check because eventually you're going to come to impartiality in judging yourself and sincerity in avowing to oneself one's inner moral worth or unworth. So he seems to think that there's that can be kept in check if done in the right way, whatever that means. Sadly, we're out of time, but stay tuned for another episode. You've been listening to Ethic Talk. Stay safe. And stay sane. Bye-bye.